Thanks, Dan, for the introduction and the invitation. I feel that when you spend 10 or 15 years of your life working on things that people can measure and real, call it real physics, a stretch, but at least things that experimentalists can use in their Monte Carlos, then you earn your badge and you can actually do things like this, as you'll see. Well, I did tell Mike that that was a thought. This was a perfect place for this. And yes, I mean, Jim pointed this out. I'm coming from the U.S. We use Fahrenheit. That's what that. The transparency is only meant to show that I know how to copy and paste things like the logo that you find on the web. Okay, there's a lot of literature. I put this in here because since this gets recorded, if somebody wants to go look at some of the references. But this is a very incomplete list of references of the last couple of years of the work that has been done. But a lot of this is based on really old work, which is very small, so you cannot see it. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about that to start with. I'll start with a couple of pictures. I also got this from the web. I'm going to start the talk by telling you about quantum mechanics with indefinite metric, which is kind of the heart of the idea. And I'll spend some time on this. And it's based on work from people that you actually probably respect and know well. This is the founder of the subject, Paul Dirac. And I found it very interesting that the picture I got from, I think it was Wikipedia, says here, Paul Dirac at a super collider workshop in the early 1930s, he was really prescient. The other picture I also got from Wikipedia, and this is Wolfgang Pauli, who also plays an important role in the development of indefinite metric quantization. And the comment is also very telling. It says there is a sign error in the Maxwell equations. But you'll see, actually, there's probably a sign error there. But there's well, let's not get into that sign. There's lots of interesting signs that I have to show you. So that was pretty cool. But anyway, what is this indefinite metric quantization? When in quantum mechanics, you have an inner product, and usually you take that inner product to be positive definite. And because it is a positive definite symmetric form, you can use that to define an inner product. There's a better way of saying it. I mean, as you know your linear algebra very well, you know that you can define a metric in terms of which you can define an inner product. And the metric doesn't have to be defined to be positive definite. If you have a non-positive definite metric, then you have what we call indefinite metric quantization. Now, let's go through some of the basics of this because it's not something that you're very familiar with. I'll convince you later that you actually are familiar with it, just forgot. The first thing is that what you want to require is not that the metric, that the Hamiltonian be Hermitian, but that it be self-adjoint. So by Hermitian, you mean the usual thing. The Hermitian conjugate is the transpose complex conjugate. If you take the matrix element of the Hamiltonian between two states and you have an indefinite metric, then when you try to compare it to this complex conjugate, you have this factor of the metric. So you really want to define the adjoint to be the object that you want the Hamiltonian to be self-adjoint instead of Hermitian. Now, from that, you can immediately, the standard computation that you do to show that a Hermitian Hamiltonian has real eigenvalues, if you use it here, you discover very quickly that the eigenvalues of a self-adjoint operator are either real, in which case the norm is generally non-zero, or complex, in which case they come in complex conjugate pairs. And then those eigenstates are actually of zero norm. And so there's two eigenstates, complex conjugate with each other, eigenvalues complex conjugate with other. The eigenstates are of zero norm, but the inner product between them is actually non-zero. It can always be taken to be normalized to one. Now, suppose that you're trying to do to take a theory, say a quantum field theory, and have a system where the inner product is indefinite. Then you can kind of see that if you try to build an S matrix, it's not going to be unitary in the sense of S dagger S equal to 1. It's going to be more like S bar S equal to 1, which can be written this way. This is what we call a pseudo-unitary, which is a little bit of a problem because you really want to conserve probabilities, and this doesn't, right? This has some elements where S dagger S is negative or minus 1. So if you try to go ahead and build a theory blindly based on an indefinite metric system, you're going to have troubles of consistency. And the question is, how do you get around that? And Lee and Wick, that's what the LW is going to be standing for throughout the talk, basically give you a prescription. And they say, if you manage to find a system so that somehow all of the eigenstates of the Hamiltonian with real eigenvalues, these kinds, have positive inner product, not just non-zero, but positive, then, in fact, the restriction of the S matrix to the states with real eigenvalues will give you a unitary S matrix. And the restriction of the S to those states will come out also automatically, as we'll see. So how does that work? I'll get to that. Well, first of all, I wanted to say indefinite metric sounds like, you're going to go into a swamp. It is a little bit of a swamp, but it's not something that you should be very afraid of. I mean, you're familiar with indefinite metric because the Lorentz metric is indefinite. And yes, okay, the first time you went from Euclidean space to Lorentz space, you said, oh, my God. But you've overcome that by now. But more interestingly, gauge fields are like that, right? The zeroth component of a gauge field has negative metric, and you don't seem to be bothered about that. And in fact, when you quantize, when you go through the complete quantization of a gauge field, you know that you end up combining two states, the longitudinal component and the zeroth component of the state, they combine into states with a zero norm. And those are, in fact, their complex eigenvectors are actually real, but in that case. But nevertheless, those actually play the role of those zero norm eigenvectors that I mentioned before. And all of the other states have positive norms. So that's one example of what I was showing you before. And of course, what happens here is a little bit simpler because by gauge invariance, you can show that those states actually just decouple. But you do see that the S matrix is unitary in that case. One of the interesting things that happens here is that gauge invariance allows you to show that these states are not asymptotic states, they decouple. The same thing happens in string theory. If you think of basic quantization in string theory, the X0 component and the longitudinal component of the bosonic string play exactly the same role, same story. So these things you've seen.
Pop up ghosts too, right?
Sorry. Well, I'm going to. Father pop up ghosts too, they also decouple. Yeah.
Are there any examples where you have a negative metric space and not a gauge symmetry?
That's not what we're talking about.
Exactly.
So these are the cast of characters, TDD and Giancarlo. We have that idea that the interdisciplinary matrix will become possible in some of these series if the negative matrix states that you would have naively, say before eternal interactions, actually are unstable states. So that's the picture. You have some positive norm states, some negative norm states. The negative norm states actually, when you turn on the interaction, become unstable, so they're not asymptotic states. They're not really states in the theory. And they satisfy the previous condition. And the S matrix, which really applies only to the other states, because they are asymptotic states, will be unitary. So let's see how that works. And I have some very explicit examples so you get an idea of what this is. So I'm just repeating that. And the strategy, in a little bit more detail, is by strategy, I mean how do you arrange for this to happen automatically. So basically, you want to turn on the interactions so that these negative norm states become unstable. So think about, in the free theory, they have some heavy states, so that's part of the strategy. When the states are going to have a negative norm be heavy, heavy enough that when you turn on the interactions, they can decay into positive norm states, which I'm calling P here for positive as well. Now, you know from quantum mechanics that you can have, in a non-perturbed theory, some heavy state N, which is actually degenerate with a multiparticle state, which I call here PP, two particles, for example. When I turn on the interactions that allows these things to mix, the would-be eigenstate N and the would-be eigenstate PP actually mix with each other, and results in making the N state unstable. So, in fact, when these two states mix, you get this pair of states with a complex energy, and that complex energy can be interpreted as giving you the width of this unstable state. But for us, what matters is that as the state became unstable, the negative metric states disappeared, and all we ended up with were these zero norm states. These are like our plus and minus of before, zero norm states with complex eigenenergies. Of course, if these were normalized to one, you can see that this combination I wrote down corresponds to zero norm states.
What is this a PP state? What is PP state
that we wrote? A PP state is a very shorthand for a two part a state of two particles. So this is a little bit hand waving, and I'm going to give you a very concrete example in a moment. But I'm just trying to appeal to your previous knowledge of basic quantum mechanics, where when you have a continuum and then a discrete state, and allow them to actually interact with each other, then the discrete state becomes unstable. That's really what I'm trying to appeal to. So PP is part of the continuum, okay, being a multi-particle state. So let me give you an example so you understand better what I'm talking about. And I'm going to use this quite a bit. This is a higher derivative Lagrange. It's a single scalar field with a higher derivative term and just some potential, say a quartic potential. Now, the higher derivative term can be traded for two fields. And let me show you how you do that. So here's another Lagrangian, which has a field chi, except that this field chi has no interactions. So the equations of motions are really just equations of constraint, and it's very easy to figure it out. You take the derivative with respect to chi. That gives you the chi is equal to d squared phi over m squared. You plug that back in here, you solve the constraint, and you get this Lagrangian. So the dynamics of these two Lagrangians are identical. They're equivalent. But now, I can take that Lagrangian and redefine the field phi, or you want to introduce a field phi without a hat, which is phi hat shifted by chi. In other words, I complete these squares here. And you get this equivalent Lagrangian again, which looks like a Lagrangian with two fields, both with the normal number of derivatives, except that this new field chi has the wrong kinetic energy term, the wrong sign for the kinetic energy term, and also the wrong sign for the mass, the two go together. And the potential has a very specific structure. So I'll actually kind of shift around between these two languages of thinking about this Lagrangian as a high derivative Lagrangian, or this view that it has an auxiliary field, but with the normal number of derivatives. It's kind of convenient to shift between them. And one of the nice things about it is that it shows you that this high derivative Lagrangian has an indefinite metric problem. That's a minus sign in front there. So let me take the higher derivative. This previous higher derivative Lagrangian may be written in terms of these two fields. And for definiteness, let's consider a cubic potential, which is the simplest thing you can write down. And here's the Feynman rules for this theory. The normal field phi has a propagator that you know. The other field has a propagator, which has a minus sign in the residue, and a different mass. Pretty straightforward. The interactions are all just IG up to a sign. This sign actually is not going to play any role. I just can tell you that now, so you don't have to keep track of it. And here's the basic problem of having a negative metric theory. If you take scattering, let's take the scattering of these two of these normal-looking particles, and I'm going to insist always that this m be much larger than this little m, so that you know for sure that these are states that are going to be stable and part asymptotic states in the S matrix. So I can compute this S matrix for scattering of these guys, and at tree level there's two diagrams. And you learn to do those in kindergarten, so you can do them here in your head. It's just the sum of the two propagators times the coupling constant. And given that, I can compute the forward scattering amplitude by just taking the imaginary part of this. The kinematics for forward scattering is kind of obvious here. And when you take the imaginary part, you should put back in the I epsilon, you get a delta function from each one of the two terms. And you see this is a disaster. It's a disaster because the second term has a minus sign. And the imaginary part of the forward scattering amplitude, according to the optical theorem, is the total cross-section, which by definition is positive. And the cross-section is the square of something. There's no argument. So you cannot have an equality between these two things because This side is negative. It's negative somewhere, whereas this other side is positive always. Now, this is not a surprise. This is a violation to unitarity. This is because in this theory, as far as I've pushed it, S dagger S is not one. You have a pseudo-unitary S matrix. I haven't shown you how the Hamiltonian is not Hermitian, but trust me, it isn't. I mean, is Hermitian, is not Hermitian, it's self-adjoint. So how do we actually incorporate this idea of Lie and Wick? Well, when Lie and Wick tell us is very simple, they say, just take into account in that calculation that you just did, the fact that that this heavier state is unstable. Now, because it is unstable, I'm not going to put it in an external leg, but I didn't do that in the previous graph. What I should do is take care of the fact that the propagator is modified because it's an unstable state. So let me do that. In fact, let me do old-fashioned perturbation theory. In old-fashioned perturbation theory, I mean the following. You first replace all of the propagators by the full propagator, even if you don't know how to do the calculation, but you imagine that you do that. And then you do perturbation theory in the vertices the standard way. Now, this is something that people developed a long time ago because they appreciated that if you have resonances, like the W and the Z, for example, then if you don't dress the propagators, you have problems with perturbation theory, because if you get very near a pole, the graphs blow up regardless of the order in perturbation theory that you're going to. So in order to get things under control, you first put in the width in those propagators, which keeps you away from the blow up. And then you do your perturbation theory. So let me do that. So how do you do that? This is a standard computation that you all know. I first do the full two-point function, which I do by resumming the one PIs, the one particle reducible functions, which I call pi, propagator called delta. And of course, this is just the geometric sum that you know and love. And let me actually do for you a couple of steps. Let me apply this first for the standard type of, for the standard type of propagator. So the standard type of propagator, the two-point function looks like this, which you recognize. For the other propagator, which simply refers by this overall sign, doesn't look like much of a difference. You get an overall sign here. But there's another difference. Notice the sign in front of the self-energy, or the 1PI function. This is going to play a role. Now, the self-energy itself is completely normal-looking. Even for the normal particle or this Liebig auxiliary field, the graphs that go in are identical. Remember, these vertices are the same, and the particles running around the loop are the same. So these functions are the same. So there's nothing special about the function. It's this sign that's going to matter. And let me show you how that matters. Let's go back to the scattering amplitude that I computed before, but now put in to this intermediate state here, this full propagator. Okay. And when you define a scattering amplitude in field theory, there's a very specific prescription as to how you do this. You do this computation with complex P square, and then the actual physical value is obtained by approaching from the positive imaginary part side of the complex plane, the real axis. That's the prescription in field theory. We can go back to where that comes from later if you have questions. So if you do that with this function, you find that there's no poles in the upper half plane. And when you get to the real axis, you find a cut. And the cut has to do with some logs and square roots in pi. And you know where that comes from. You've done the computation before. It has to do with the multi-particle cut in the two-particle cut in this one loop diagram, if you only have one loop. Now, because that function is real on the real axis away from the cut, you can use the green reflection, the Schwarz reflection principle, to show that since there were no singularities up here, no poles, there's no poles in the lower half plane either. So that's the complete analytic structure of that function. Now, here's what's interesting. If you do the same analysis for the second term, remember the second term comes from the from that graph, so there's our minus sign. But looking just at the analytic structure of this function, you find that because of this minus sign, there is a pole in the upper half plane, which is very unusual, something you haven't seen before. Now, the same argument tells you there must be a complex conjugate pole in the lower half plane. So you have a pair of poles. And if you approach the real axis, then you find the same cut as before. Now, if you look at the structure, you can rewrite the two-point function just by a dispersion relation as the sum of two isolated poles plus the contribution from a cut. And the contribution from a cut just looks like the standard contribution for a propagator. It just looks like the one from this, in a sense, with a spectral density, which is actually positive. Because it's the same pi function as before. And there's a sum rule. Doesn't matter what sum rule is. There's a sum rule here that follows never mind. Let's skip that. So now let me do the computation we did before. Let me take this amplitude, properly defined with this resum propagators like that, and understanding the full analytic structure of this as given by that expression. Well, when I take the imaginary part of that, this first term is actually going to give me, instead of a delta function, now I get, the delta function gets resolved into this contribution from the cut. The discontinuity across the cut is actually just the spectral density, right? And I put a mu squared here, it should be a p squared, the momentum, at the s of the scattering, right? The total energy of the scattering. And then you have a second contribution from here, but this complex conjugate poles cancel from the, when you take the imaginary part. And then this other contribution actually comes with the correct sign, with the plus sign. It's really the same contribution as in the normal case. I can explain the plus sign in more detail if anybody has questions. The point is that now this looks very nice and positive, and we're not going to have a problem with positive versus negative in the optical theorem. And in fact, you can actually check, computing the cross-section, that there is an equality to disorder and perturbation theory. That in fact, unitarity holds to that only perturbation theory. You can kind of see how it goes, because you're familiar with that computation when you only have one particle self-interacting, right? So that's really how this thing works. And it was this magic of taking care of the fact that these particles are unstable that did two things for us. First of all, it took a negative residue here and shifted it into a dipole of negative residues, a complex dipole of negative residues, plus a compensating positive residue on the cod. That was part of the magic. The other part of the magic is that now, because it is unstable, I cannot actually put it on an outside state. Okay. So
if Kepler lambda is small compared to little m, then the whole stability thing would change.
Yes. Yes. I'd like to discuss maybe privately that situation later. But we don't really know how to get it to work. let me just make some quick statements, because I don't want to lose so much time on these formalities anymore. This case I just showed you is actually fairly simple, and it's easy to understand in a way because of the following. Once you make a particle unstable, you can think of it as having a complex mass because it has a width, just physically, regardless of the technicalities. The reason things kind of worked in the previous case is that when I make a scattering of two real particles, the energy that goes across the diagram is real energy, and I can never actually put that intermediate particle on shell if it has complex energy, a complex mass. And if I cannot put it on shell, that means it doesn't contribute to the unitarity relation as an external state, and that's really what made it all work. And there are then subtleties that happen when you have two of these particles in intermediate state, because if they have complex conjugate eigen energies or masses, you can actually take real energy and split it into two complex conjugate energies in scattering. So there's some subtleties, and it's known how to deal with them. And let me not give you the details, except to mention that some of the prescription for dealing with that was given by Lee and Wick, and some of it was supplemented by Kutkowski, Olive Polkinghorne, and I forget who the L is, darn. This thing works at one loop, I can assure you. At all orders, there's no proof that it works. General arguments have been made, but there's no real proof. Kutkowski and company, who invented the rest of the prescription that is necessary, actually analyzed complete sets of Langshoff, that's the L, sorry. complete sets of diagrams, not the whole perturbative series, but just classes of diagrams, infinite classes of diagrams, And some are very complicated, and they show it works in all of the cases that they could study, but they couldn't actually just do it in arbitrary, for an arbitrary graph. Tombouldis actually solved a particular theory, which of n spinors coupled to Einstein gravity. Then it takes the large n limit in a particular way, and the Fermi determinant can be computed in that limit, and you're left with a theory of gravity with higher derivatives when he does that. So in that limit, you have something that looks like a theory of higher derivative gravity, which would be an example of this thing, just way more complicated. And that's what he was interested in, because people had proven that higher derivative gravity is renormalizable, which is kind of interesting. But on the other hand, he knows that underlying this theory is a perfectly nice unitary theory. So he could actually show that the theory is unitary. And he, because of that connection, there was no need to use any of these prescriptions. Right, I think he only gets curvature squared.
That's to do with the large n limit,
though? It has to do with, yeah, with integrating. So you integrate the fermions and you would get a whole bunch of different terms. But then you take a large n limit in which you take n and n Planck to, you know, to be held constant when n goes to infinity and some power of n Planck is going to zero. That's the effective n Planck of that theory. I don't remember the details, but that's the idea. I mean, the fact that you have better in ultraviolet behavior, you should not be a surprise. You have higher derivatives, put more power in the denominator. I'll come back to that, because that plays a role in the next aspect of what I want to talk about. And finally, we actually solved a large N model. Four dimensions, scalars, so we have n scalars, so we have an On symmetry, and you can actually, with a quartic self-coupling, but that's all you have the On symmetry. And in that case, we actually had to use explicitly this prescription, and we just showed unitary explicitly. We just computed the diagram, which you can do exactly in the large N limit, and the Hollis matrix, basically. And you can test, and it works. So there's examples that this works to all orders, in at least in large N theories, and evidence that it works in all classes of theories, but there's no proof.
Your theory was N scalars coupled to
gravity? No. It's just N scalars.
What was the inherent?
So this is N scalars coupled to gravity with a higher derivative term. Sorry. So we take a higher, it's just like the theory I had before. Yeah, it's n scalars, and instead of a cubic coupling, have a quartic because I want to have the On symmetry. And so it's actually very similar to the computations I show you. Now that we have to be careful to resum infinite classes of diagrams in the large N limit, and it all works. Okay. So I gave this talk at Lausanne some time ago, and
the question here.
Oh, there's the question.
In the original simple model with the scalar fields, mm-hmm. Is there a problem with the energy being unbounded from below? I could imagine that you might not see that unless you put in a finite.
It's a very good question. So it depends on how you quantize the. If you think in terms of the two field formalism, the auxiliary field, it depends on how you do the quantization for the second field. If you insist on the Hamiltonian being Hermitian instead of just plainly self-adjoint, and to have a definite metric instead of an indefinite metric, then the energy is unbounded from below. So if you want to solve the problem of boundedness of the energy, then you're forced to having an indefinite quantization. And that's how it works. We can do the algebra, but it takes a while, so I can show you. But I can show you, it's a perfectly good question, because that's actually what drives you into indefinite metric quantization. So when I gave this talk at Lausanne, when I was in Europe recently, Ricardo Ratazzi tried to defend what I was doing by saying, you see, Lee, Wick, Coleman, Gross, not everyone who's worked on this is a crackpot. And I think he, I don't know what he was thinking about us. So take that as you wish, except these are the photos of these people, so I don't know. Anyway, I don't often do this, but I have to, so that you don't think I'm a total crackpot, remind you that the whole story started with people who are really somewhat more respected. So anyway.
Now, did they actually come up to a hard point and then they just gave up track and such? Or they...
Okay, so the rat kind of proposed it and then he tipped his stuff as always. And Polly actually pushed it. And then with Villars, he realized that, hey, this is a very nice way of regulating integrals. And then they went off in the direction of, this is where Polly-Villars regression comes from, right? You notice that higher derivatives is equivalent to putting a field that, so if I take that extra field and take this, its mass to infinity, it becomes a regulator. And that's where Polly-Villars came from. But there were issues as to how to deal with unitarity that they didn't understand. Then Lee and Wick actually kind of came up with an interesting proposal for that. That was in the, so, Polly and Dirac were talking 30s. Then Lee and Wick is 60s. They're doing this because the problems understanding renormalizability of quantum electrodynamics. And in particular, they were insisting on understanding the proton-neutron mass difference. The proton and neutron were thought to be elementary particles, believe it or not, at one point. And in electrodynamics, you think that being their mass difference and electromagnetic effect, you should be able to compute it. But you do the computation, out comes an infinite result. So they thought there's something wrong with the theory. Let's change the theory. And right around the time they're doing this, it becomes appreciated that gauge theories are, that quarks exist, first of all, that late 60s. So proton and neutron have structure, which cuts off the integrals. And number one and number two, a few years later, gauge theories becomes known that they're renormalizable. So the whole thing is kind of dropped. Not completely. People kept working on it. Gross wrote some interesting stuff about it in the early 80s because he started. There was some interest in this theory's poem. Now talking about history, so I'm going to take one more minute. In the early 80s, people started getting interested in quantum theories of gravity again. And it's proven by Tom Bullis and someone. I'll come. Ignatius, what's his last name?
Antoniadis.
Antoniadis and Tom Bullis, I think, were the ones who show that higher derivative gravity is renormalizable. And the beta function is computed and is found to be asymptotically free. What a wonderful thing, right? And so now how do you make sense of these theories if they are non-Hermitian, non-unitary, and so on. So people remember about this Lee-Wick stuff, and so Gross has some interesting, Bolwer and Gross had an interesting paper about this series in general, exploring how to make a functional integral, which is very difficult, and they don't succeed, basically. And as this is going on, out comes the first string revolution in 1984, and people say, quantum gravity strings, and this whole thing is dropped. So that's
the lesson is that people study this stuff and then something else comes along and then they drop this. And
right, that's
so you're studying this, so we'll have breakthroughs somewhere else. Breakthroughs is coming.
Yeah, get ready.
So hurry up before the breakthrough. Right? That's what you should take out of this stuff. That's right. So let me show you. Here's what I want to do, because there's only, 17, 18 minutes left. I'm going to show you in a few minutes some very peculiar effects that you're not familiar with, which are fascinating. And this is really what's driving my curiosity these days. And then in 10 minutes, I'm going to just flash a number of results. It is what actually got us interested in these things in the first place, which are kind of more phenomenologically interesting. So let me show you this stuff by reminding you first of response theory, which you probably studied this again in kindergarten. Let me take a free field theory, for example. It doesn't have to be a free field, but a free field theory is a good example. You put a source here, so you couple your field to a source, and the Fourier transform of the source is given by AFK, which you take to be a concentrated function around some K0. And in configuration space, you have this source kind of localized around the origin in spacetime. And then I put a second, an absorber V1. It's a second source, but with the opposite Fourier component in time. And I call that Fourier transform G of K. It's also localized at K0, but in space is localized at some point, y mu, and that point is away from the origin by proper time tau. So if you take now the inner product of the source and the detector, remember the source and the absorber are really just coupling to this single scalar field, a very simple computation, you find the following. You find that the inner product has an exponential, which is what you expect. M is the energy, which is the mass of the object. So this is the usual exponential of B to the I energy T. The wave function spreads in three dimensions, like three-half power. So that the modulus goes like 1 over t cubed, obvious. And then you have these Fourier transforms evaluated at the physical momentum, m times y over tau. But y over tau is just the speed. You can do the computation. I can show it to you. It's very cool. But I'm betting that many of you did it already in your first course in field theory. Now, this is a warm-up, because what I really want to do first before I go to the Liwi case, is replace this thing with an interacting theory, and now think of this coupling to a narrow resonance, which is narrow but unstable. Okay? So you do the computation, you get pretty much the same result, except you get this extra factor here, e to the minus gamma tau, which tells you that this thing is decaying in time, because the resonance, even if narrow, has finite lifetime. And of course, the width is interpreted as the inverse lifetime. Everybody happy with that. There's one more thing that I want to point out. There's this theta function, theta y0. It actually comes out of the calculation automatically. It tells you that if you put your detector before the particle is emitted, you're not going to see anything. You have to turn on the detector after the particle is emitted and then turn it off. If you turn it off before the particle is emitted, you're not going to see anything. Pretty dumb stuff, right? Okay, now let me do the same thing for the Liwi resonance. This particle that is unstable then comes with the wrong residue in the propagator, right? We've been looking at. So, in fact, this is kind of the wrong picture. If you do the calculation outcomes, this thing, this minus sign that we're talking about, shows up in all of these places. Okay, and the first thing that should catch your eye is e theta of minus y0. It tells you that the picture is wrong, that the detector should be on before the particle is emitted. Okay, and it's still true that these things are exponentially damped in time, in proper time, and the direction of the momentum is appropriately changed. But what the heck does this mean? You know, what words do I put with that picture? So let me give you a physical sense of what's happening. And for that, again, let me go first to the first case. When we have a normal particle that is unstable. So here's the experiment. You have a target. You have a particle beam. When the beam hits the target, you infer from some detector out here that particle pairs come out, and you trace that back to the origin of those two, the intersection of those two trajectories, and then you count with time how many of these events you get, and you see that the number of events decreases. This is an exponential decay. Decreases exponentially away from the target. So you interpret that as saying, okay, a resonance was created, it traveled, it decayed, and what you measure was the product of those decays. Right? So that's a physical experiment. Everybody happy with that? Okay. Here's what happens in the Liwi case. You do the same experiment, and you find these particles that come out. This is what this means. The particles that come out of the collision are formed before the detector, okay? And the rate at which you see them come out is decreasing exponentially away from the target again. And causality seems to be a little bit compromised because if you could time things, it would appear that these things come out and hit the detector at a time that you infer corresponds to happening before the particle actually hits the target, the original particle hits the target. So the collision happened just before. The outcome of the collision happens just before the collision itself.
This is very much like the radiation reaction, right?
It's exactly like the radiation reaction. Right. Very good. Just, that problem is driving me. It's okay. I find this very interesting. This is why I'm concentrating on this question, and I'm looking at radiation reactions. Some interesting papers by Feynman and Wheeler. Maybe you know those. We can talk about it. It's a lot of fun. But there's nothing experimentally that tells us that this is wrong. The question is it conceptually something that we cannot live with? Is it breaking causality in a way that just throws logic out of the window? And that's not clear either. I'll come back to that question at the very end of the talk. But the fact that if you make a collision experiment and you measure a time advancement as opposed to a time delay in the outcome does not necessarily allow you to construct a grandfather's paradox. The grandfather paradox, if you don't remember, by the way, is where you travel faster than light, so you can actually send a signal back in time that has somebody kill your grandfather so that you actually don't have a mother that gives rise to you that can send a signal to kill your father. That's the problem.
Very naively, right? I was for the same reason that, I mean, it seems like you could set up some apparatus to take away the target, which is sensitive.
Yeah, that's a great question. That cannot happen. That we can more or less check. Basically, if you take away the target, there's no collision, and these things don't happen. What is interesting in this theory is that you do have evolution, which is the evolution is causal in the sense that you can take a time slice, and the Hamiltonian will produce for you the next time slice and the next time slice and so on. Right? So you cannot have a situation where you modify that into two paths and different by modifying the target. In other words, you set up your system, and then it evolves and it produces the whole evolution. And you cannot, and you have two possible evolutions. One is, with the target in place, you produce that, or with the target taken out, and then there's no collision. So you can actually check that.
So there's no information being transferred outside the light bar, is what you're saying?
There's no information. But that's what we would really, I cannot say, that generally, I can say for very specific cases like that. But generally, they would like to be able to say that, period, right?
Yeah.
Otherwise,
you've got a grandfather paradox, but if you can get information on that light problem here.
Well, so one of the things that we think might be happening is that you can get information carried out outside the light cone, but damped over proper times like this, and without an obvious way of connecting many of them together to make it macroscopic. So the one thing that I wanted to tell you at the end of the talk is our attempts to see if there's any way to make this a macroscopic issue and then show that, in fact, you can produce information that goes outside the light cone.
There's no parameter you can tune to just do that?
No, we don't know. I mean, you can make the lifetime very very long.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Make it arbitrarily long.
And you still have the question of how to use that information to produce that paradox. So if you have any good ideas, I'd love to discuss it, because that's really... Okay. So let me... in the interest of time, let me tell you what actually drove us into this, and the outline of that whole program, and the few transparencies that I want to show you in a couple of minutes. Now suppose that you do this thing and apply it to the standard model. You take the standard model and add higher derivatives. Here's the kind of things that you find. I'm going to every term which has a kinetic term, every field which has a kinetic term in the standard model, I'm going to add a higher derivative term, two more derivatives that it has. So gauge fields add something quartic in derivatives. Fermion fields add something cubic in derivative. The scalar, the Higgs, are quartic in derivative. And let's just see what happens. The theory is still renormalizable, but now there's no fine-tuning problem for the Higgs. When you do this, provided this mass parameter that you're adding is in the TV range, you have no flavor problem or electroweak precision problem. There's no obvious way. The normalization structure changes very dramatically, so you can't unify the model. We don't know how to do that. And let me not tell you about this stuff, which is just applications. This is kind of a cool thing. I mean, unitarity is not lost in vector-vector scatter, which you think would be a problem because now you have these higher derivative interactions. So the energy, there will be energy growth in the scattering of massive vectors. You have massive vectors that are partners of the photon, for example, and have a mass in the Lagrangian, so you think something goes wrong. But there's still a gauge symmetry in the theory, and it cures all of those problems automatically. It's pretty cool. But that's just technical stuff. So here's the Lagrangian, standard model Lagrangian. You add extra derivatives. We chose those in particular. Some are better than others, I have to say, but I'm not going to tell you which or why.
That's not quite fair, right? Because you're not putting the rules are in that you're not putting all possible higher derivatives. You're only putting that particular gauge one. Looks like
Let me do this computation for now with this, and I'll show you some computation we've done with the whole set of higher derivatives. The things that I'm going to tell you about right now don't care about which higher derivatives you use. The comment I made very briefly about unitarity in vector-vector scattering actually does prefer some higher derivatives in this term over others.
The pattern seems to be you've chosen things for which if I used the classical phrase in the motion, I would have had fewer derivatives again. So you've always chosen something which is the equation of motion squared or something.
That's true. And why is that unfair?
Was that part of the special feature of those?
I can tell you what the special feature of the derivatives is that I need for that vector-vector scattering case, that in fact there's a change of variables that can give me a two-field formulation with normal number of derivatives. You can actually add higher derivatives in a way that you cannot do that, and then some things don't work. So that's really the constraint that I have. But I don't use this would be a question of motion. Okay. Gauge fixing, you don't care. So very briefly, because of the time, your propagators have this extra power of momentum that makes things much more convergent in the ultraviolet. So you can take the naive degree of divergence of a graph with L loops and have the usual 4L, but now you get minus 4 times the number of propagators, internal lines. And of course, the vertices have some derivatives, because there's covariant derivatives that you put in. So there's additional powers of momentum in the vertices. You use the usual trickery with topological identities, and you get the divergent structure is given by that equation. E is the number of external lines, and you notice that at one loop, the only thing that the only divergence that you get are quadratic, and they happen for 2-point functions, and so that's E equal to. And then at two loops, you at best will get logarithmic divergences, and then above that, you don't get any divergences. And the quadratic divergences that you get could give you a quadratic sensitivity to the Higgs mass, but it turns out that they don't. And well, from the gauge fields, it's pretty obvious. The would-be quadratic divergence becomes logarithmic when you use gauge invariance. So I'm not dwelling into that. For the Higgs field, what happens, which is kind of interesting, is that the term that can give you the quadratic divergence is the one with the highest number of derivatives in the vertex. But when you have that many derivatives in the vertex, you can actually always move some of those derivatives out to the external legs. And if you actually do the computation, you find that there's no real quadratic divergence. In fact, to do the whole calculated the argument carefully in a triple vertex like that, I cannot just integrate by parts of the derivative on this field and put it on the external leg, because it can hit the gauge field. So you actually have to work in a particular gauge to make that argument. But then it still goes through. So when you do the calculation, you find that the correction to the Higgs mass is only logarithmic in the cutoff, and this scale is given by this higher derivative mass. Which makes sense, because if the higher derivative mass was used as a regulator, that would be the. Now, we actually check this in other gauges, and it's true for the physical mass. Of course, the pole mass, for example, behaves this way regardless of the gauge, which is what you expect, because it's gauge invariant.
Sounds like here's where you're using the equation of motion squared, because you're using the removing the derivatives to the external lines and getting masses back from that.
That's a good point. I haven't actually checked this whether it is. Well, for the Higgs, it's actually, there's not much more you can do, because if I put it, it's a scalar. I can always write it like that for a scalar, right? It's only for the vectors that it could be more tricky. Because you have different components. But for the vectors, the vertex self-interaction doesn't enter into this part of this calculation, so which is the only thing that can give the quadratic divergence. So for this, it's actually irrelevant.
So if you add those things that were not in the form of the equation motion, then you still...
You still have this. Yeah, this works fine. So it's interesting, because it cures the hierarchy problem. There's no quadratic divergence in the Higgs mass, if that's what you call the hierarchy problem. Okay, flavor changing neutral current, I don't have much time. I could use your question of motion here just to make this simple. Basically, what happens, just to run through this very quickly, if this, just from notation, this is the Yukawa couplings in the standard model, Higgs, quark, and this is the matrix of Yukawa couplings, definitely for the down type. Now you add to this thing this cubic derivative term with arbitrary matrices, which I take to be just numbers, times 1 over m squared, which sets the scale. And if you compute something at very low energies, like BV bar mixing, or in this case, I'm going to look at just the Z couplings. Imagine Z decays, just to check for flavor changing neutral currents. Then these terms can actually now give you off-diagonal couplings of the Z. principle.
But because you allow energy, you can think of doing perturbation theory and taking this term as a perturbation to the normal Lagrangian. It's okay, provided the derivatives are small. So in that case, I can use equations of motion. Let me add with t slash once on the left and once on the right. So I get the equations of motion, t slash and q, it's going to be h u.
So that, there it is. And what's interesting now is that this term here is suppressed by masses enough times that this perturbation from the diagonal flavored conserving coupling is tiny. It's 10 to the minus 6. It's not flavor. It's not minimal flavor violation. But you pick up the CKMs also.
But the masses is what actually makes it just incredibly tiny. So it's very protective
from flavor changing neutral currents. Automatically. We didn't have to choose these coefficients to be anything specific.
I know, but so here, supposing if I put my D's in without these slashes, so I don't, you get to use the phrase of motion.
Here's one place in which I haven't checked.
Of course, if you put a D slash with a D square, you can turn that into three D slashes and a term with a D slash and a field strength tensor. So I don't know what to do with that one. But the one with field strength tensor will not contribute directly to this. So, but it could contribute to something else. I really haven't actually thought about that question. You can also put a T mu on each side. It would be.
But you still there's computation to be done, I think. Maybe because of that identity, the only two possibilities is having the field strength, and it doesn't contribute to this process, maybe to some other,
maybe to a gamma or something. And then this operator, which doesn't contribute. So I don't know. It's a new field, and not that many things have been done. So, electroweak precision, let me just, since we ran out of time, let me tell you that provided the masses are in the TEV range, you're fine. This was done by a whole bunch of groups. They all kind of agree. Sometimes.
There's just no custodial symmetry breaking somehow? Or?
Yeah, for example, the rho parameter is automatically fine. Because it's higher derivative. Basically, what happens, I think,
is to zeroth order, the higher derivatives are the small momentum, q squared equals zero, or q squared equals mw squared, divided by the large mass. So you have that additional suppression. But of course, you know, when you start doing the one, this things were done on one loop. There's more subtle things that since I didn't actually do this, I can't answer your question more in more detail.
It sounds like there isn't actually, it's just effectively small, is what you're saying.
So for example, for the rho parameter, that happens, because I know I did that calculation, but for you know.
But not because of restrictions on what mass is going to be, just effectively it's small.
Yeah, look, I cannot tell you exactly what's going on with the I don't understand this, I didn't do the calculation, but you put in the this quark, this massive partners of the quarks, and put them into loops and see how they contribute to S and T, and you get some bounds. I don't.
So here again, it's probably the question to ask would be whether or not it's an equation of motion thing, because as long as you're using, as long as you're perturbing the powers of one ramp square, you've got a redundant operator, so you can trade blocks, give of f for the mass of the gauge scale.
Yeah,
and that would express by the mass.
Right, that's an interesting way of saying it. Of course, it's not a redundant operator because it is, I don't have an equation, the equation of motion actually includes the variation of that operator, but at low energies,
you can trade it for mass using an equation of motion. So the difference between the mass is redundant.
The equation of motion, no, the equation of motion that you want to use ignores that operator. And that you can do, I think, as an approximation to the solution of the theory when the derivatives are small, so when you have low energies.
Yeah.
And then...
Did they perturb at 1 of Ram squared here?
I don't think so. I think they just use the whole thing and do the calculation. Yes. But maybe a simpler way of getting the same result would be to do the perturbation. Yeah. So.
of course, it's a perturbation theory. In that sense, it's super true, but not in that. I mean, to put the whole propagator with the extra p to the fourth, and then do the calculation.
Does the electroweak precision bounds on the Higgs mass itself change?
Well, yeah, here you have the I don't have it. Here I have it. There's bounds on what?
First part of the answer. Bottom line, it still prefers light Higgs's.
So the red and the yellow in these two here they look the same, but there's a yellow and a red lines bound in this picture. The yellow is for a Higgs mass of 800. The red is for a Higgs mass of 114. I got it somewhere. I didn't. 114 GeV. Okay. So the yellow is, I mean, pretty much core partner of up to 10 TeV through that when the Higgs is 800 GeV. But when the Higgs is light, like 120 GeV, then, you know, the core masses are above a TeV in both directions. So, yeah, that's...
So it looks like it's just a small correction. It's not adding something positive delta T sort of contribution.
Okay. Here's where we actually looked at all of these other possible derivatives, looking at the running. But we ran out of time. I mentioned this. I'm not going to show you. I want to show you this graph, and then I'll give you my conclusion. So I'm a little bit behind. In an effort to try to understand this causality issue and whether you can take these collisions and build up some sort of non-causal kind of classical information transfer, we thought of what if we try to make a gas, a thermal gas of these particles. There's going to be lots of collisions, and then we can excite a sound wave, and perhaps we can see a signal of a causality on long distances if the sound wave, once we excite these particles, travels faster than the speed of light. So that was the idea, and we thought it was worth a shot. And the calculation is a mess. We don't even know that we have it right. It's a mess because the standard methods for thermal Green's functions and thermal functional integrals don't apply here. There's no way to do functional integrals and so on. But fortunately, we found some old papers that tell you how to do thermal calculations just using an S matrix. And it's a complicated mess. And in addition, we're not sure that it would apply directly to this kind of theory, but we used it anyway. And what we found was that when you look at the free energy, the contribution of the liquid particle looks very much like that of a normal particle, except that it has a minus sign in front. So when you add together, say, well, here's the energy density and the pressure, and they just look normal. There's a t to the fourth term, the t squared term, and so on. And the normal contribution would look like this, except, of course, with a plus sign in both cases. So when you add the normal particle, and you have to have the normal particle, remember, it was part of the deal, because if this liquid particle has to decay into that in order to have any target. So when you add them together, this is a high temperature expansion. At high temperature, when you add them together, this leading term cancels with the normal. Then the next term here, which has a power of the mass, is positive for the liquid case and it's negative for the normal one, so the sum still gives you something positive. Not only that, it's curious that this term is equal to that. So the question of state at very high temperature approaches 1. Not minus 1, 1. Okay? So what does that mean? Here's something kind of interesting. So the equation of state, the square root of the equation of state is the speed of sound, which is what I was after. And here it's plotted as a function of temperature.
Ignore the blue line. They look the same. So at zero temperature, you haven't excited this Liouville state, and the equation of state is the square root of a third, right? Just the 3-4 radiation. So the equation of the usual equation of state is the square of this, right? So there will be a third. So I'm taking the square root to get the speed of sound. So the speed of sound is that. And when you increase the temperature, this starts taking over, and the speed of sound approaches the speed of light, but it never reaches that. It always stays below. So it's a very peculiar behavior, but it doesn't violate causality. For fermions, we have a disaster, and we don't understand it. We get that overall negative energy density at high temperatures. We don't know what that means, so it's an open question. Okay, I probably bored you to that. So I wanted to show us what happens with thermal stuff when you conclude that total energy is negative. So you better just burn it away from your transparency. So I believe there are actually unitary higher derivative theories, and I hope I made some argument for that here. As I said, we actually know that that's true at large n, because we've done this. The standard model version of the higher derivative, this higher derivative version of the standard model, has no fine tuning for the Higgs, has no flavor problem or electro weak problem, the mass is larger than a QTV. We don't have to do Gauss. And so there's some open questions there. And and in the case of gravity, there's still the open question that always existed, which is that you get a unitary theory of gravity. You can make a higher derivative theory which is asymptotically free that includes gravity, which is pretty cool, but maybe it's not unitary. Nobody knows the answer to that still. A causality is kind of very cool, but it could be a disaster. On the other hand, we don't know that it is a disaster, and it could be something that shows up experimentally, so we should keep our eyes open. This is why I'm kind of interested in this at the time. And I'll conclude by saying that there seems to be other places where these high derivatives keep popping up now and then. And many of you are interested in cosmology, and you've noticed that in the literature in the last few years, there's been a raising interest in higher derivative in cosmology. So if these kind of theories don't find good use in solving the hierarchy problem, they might in fact find another use in making sense of some of these cosmological theories, which eventually will have to face the problem of what happens to unitarity, what happens to stability, what happens to causality, and so on. So thanks for your attention, and I'll take some questions.
So the strongest constraint is coming from electric precision data, because for flavor you're getting these effective CKM suppressions?
Yes. And it's kind of... Because we knew that this constraint was there, that M had to be more than a few TV, more than a couple TV, and I said, well, I didn't actually do the flavor work. It was someone else. So in that work, the analysis of whether these interactions are safe or not already uses masses in that range.
Yeah.
And then also ask the question, how far down can we push it?
Mm-hmm.
So it could be that you can push it farther down, but it's kind of a problem.
And so these other states... Can you singly produce these things and then they decay and then you have some sort of signature, or do you have to doubly get the prism of pairs?
No, you can singly produce them. You saw someone. It's hard for you to keep track of the higher derivative Lagrangian in the standard model, let alone how to translate that into something that looks like has two components and so on. But yeah, there's interactions, just like in the G5 cubed example that I showed you. There are interactions which are odd in the new particle, or just proportional to the new particle. So you can singly produce it. And remember, the scattering amplitude that I showed in that simple example was basically production of one of these particles that then decays. Right? So that's true here also. And the problem is, and I kind of didn't want to spend any time on this. This again is something I didn't do. This is Tom Rizzo. And these graphs are comparing production of a W type, a partner of the W boson, or a partner of the Z at LHC. I'm actually trying to use an atlas-like cut in both cases. And the different lines, one is the big weak case, which is in black, and all of the other colors, I don't remember which is which, correspond to other models, or the more standard looking models of new W's.
Just W primes of various.
Yeah, W primes of various kinds. And you can't tell the difference from this, right? Same thing here. So, yeah, you can actually discover them. You're just not going to know that that's what you have in your hands. Nobody has done the exercise of how to do the experiment that tells you this. But in principle, I know the way to do it, which is if you think about time advancements and time delays in terms of what happens in the scattering amplitude, a time delay, which is the one that you're familiar with, when you go through a resonance, it means that the phase of the resonance moves counterclockwise in the complex plane by 2 pi, by pi, right? And that's a standard behavior that you're used to. If you ever heard of the Arcand diagram, that's a circle that you write down. If you have a time advancement, it actually goes in the opposite direction. Now, all of the standard resonances give you time delays. So if you could actually plot the Arcand diagram for one of these resonances, you would discover that it's going in the opposite direction of normal.
What about just timing the events? I mean, if you could see that some things were coming off earlier than you expected.
Well, so for that, so the width, so it's easy to estimate the width, right? It's going to be some standard model coupling, which are order one, times the mass of the object, which is a few TeV. Divided by 8 pi squared. So the lifetime is ridiculously small.
Okay.
So you just...
No hope.
No hope. So the question is, how do you measure phase shifts? And the problem is that, the last phase shift was measured in particle physics was measured somewhere like in the late 50s, right? When all of that... So the people who know how to do this are all long dead. It turns out they measure phase shifts, of course, in all other areas of physics all the time. And so the technology is still there. You need to do exclusive scattering. So it's not just this stuff where you do, PP into a W, which then decays into any amount of stuff that you have to actually have an exclusive final state and into a couple of different channels, so you can actually compare relative phases.
Sorry.
And the only way to do this, as far as I know, would be at the IOC. Nobody has done a study. It would be pretty cool if they find something like this, and then 20 years later at the ILC, they actually find this thing going the wrong direction. I'll be dead by now. By then, I won't be able to go to Stockholm.
So to go back to the beginning of your talk, that you essentially restore unitarity by making these particles unstable, and you know that all in this external space, right?
Right.
So with the lifetime is associated a certain energy scale, so that means take your gas at particles and heat up the temperature so that the typical energy becomes of that energy scale. So all of a sudden you populate those states, right? So what happens then? I mean, are you then violating unitarity or?
That's why we try to do this calculation in the terminal state.
Is that the calculation?
So this
gives you the density. This is basically the density of those states, right? Or this is the energy density in those states. That's probably one way of interpreting that.
Have you tested it for stability? I mean, it sounds like the spirit would be, you look at susceptibilities, are they all positive?
The only thing I've computed was the speed of sound. The only thing that I can actually compute is, well, I can do a little bit more than that. I can compute the free energy, and I can put a chemical potential. Those things I know how to do with this method of this old method of Dashen and Ma, computing free energies from the S matrix.
Once you got that, it sounds like it, and I don't have to, I can forget where you, how you got it, and just start differentiating it to get thermodynamic functions.
Right.
And if it's just an overall sign, it sounds like every second derivative I would have expected to be positive if not negative.
Right. Well, remember that I have to add to this the normal particle contribution. Right? So there are.
So it would be a question of whether it's dominated by M or.
But this M with the other. Right, exactly. Yeah, I haven't actually done any further study of thermal properties. Partly because I'm more worried about the instability that we do see in the fermion case. And we're not sure whether it is physical and it's the end of the story, or it's an artifact of this way of doing the calculation, which we really don't understand very well because it's a complicated method, or something else. So I'm concentrating more on that problem than understanding the thermodynamics of the system. But it's interesting. I mean, I think you have a good point. You can take more derivatives and see what the heat capacity.
For cosmology, you know, you're holding yourself to a higher bar than I think most cosmologists do. Because, and I think most of the things that they like those theories, what they like about those theories is that they do have runaway solutions, right? That's mm-hmm. what they're using them for. And that's what you're excluding when you're making them
right.
So it's
now, one thing that I haven't told you, and that's partly, because we're 25 minutes over time, but also because it's not very well understood, is the correspondence principle. Right? So this is all, I've given you a completely quantum picture of this, but how do you go to that, from that picture to classical field theory, which is what cosmologists use? I'll tell you that in one sentence, with the caveat that I'm not 100% sure that this is exactly how it works. When you look at this prescription that I didn't really carefully elucidate for you of Lee and Wick and Kotkowski and company as to how to deal with the Green's functions in perturbation theory. It's really a prescription on how you take contours of integration, how the poles move around, and so on. I'm giving you a prescription for the Green's functions that would actually solve the classic equations in field theory. And those prescriptions actually correspond to particular choices of boundary conditions. And I believe that what they say is that there's a boundary condition that at future infinity, the solution there is no exponential growth in the solution.
If it's like radiation reaction, that's what it sounds like, very much like what you would have to do, and that's how you get the causal thing.
That's right.
But then you're removing the thing that the cosmologists love, is that they're growing. That's
the exponential growth. So,
it might be that you make some of these things into good theories, and they'll have to abandon them all for cosmology.
Maybe, yeah. Well, if they can live with unitarity violation, then that's okay.
Oh, they can look at
it. Right. So we're motivated by unitarity and stability, of course. But I think stability is a little bit of an afterthought because it's the classical picture.
Well, we're over time, so let me thank you.